You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back, Tom Hartmann. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartmann here with you. Welcome back. Good grief. I've been recording promos for radio stations. It just kind of felt like I'd already been on the air. Anyhow. Oh, my. It's the day before Friday the 13th. So, and Megyn Kelly is on TV saying that Jesus was white and so was Santa Claus. And, hey, it's just a fact. It's a historical fact. Kids, get used to it. And so what better day than to talk about how in 11 states, you and I, with our taxpayer dollars, are supporting creationist curriculum, homeschool curriculum, with a creationist bent, which is going to kneecap, in my opinion, this country and these children should they ever decide to go into the sciences or pretty much anything other than going to Liberty University where you can get in without even having to take a GED. Eric Hovind is with us. He's the president of Creation Today. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. Why would anybody want to do this to their children? It seems like it borders on child abuse. To be teaching children science in the context of religion, when religion and science are two completely different areas, or for that matter, to be teaching religion as a statement of fact, when there are other religions that believe very different things, and there's no comparative religion really in this curriculum, or to be teaching kids that basically Jesus was a political conservative in the modern mold, and that liberals are somehow evil people. I don't get it.
Well, obviously you and I come from opposing views then, because I would disagree strongly with some of the statements you made. Why should we let Christians teach their kids what they believe about creation and do that in science? We find creation scientists all over the United States. It hasn't kneecapped or handicapped them whatsoever.
Well, I'm sure they can find a few, you know, billionaire right-wing Christians who want to fund them, particularly those who own big oil companies who want to fund them to you know, promote a science that suggests that you know, global warming isn't going to screw up the world. But, you know, that's a very, very limited marketplace. And my primary objection is that in 11 states, our tax dollars are paying for this stuff.
Well, let me tell you what's even worse than that. In all 50 states, tax dollars are going to tell the kids that they are cousins of bananas and that they all evolved from rocks 3 billion years ago. That's being forced down the kids' throats in all 50 states.
So you think that the minerals in your body did not start out as rocks?
What I'm saying, we did not evolve from a random process over billions of years.
How do you know that?
Originally coming from the earth, which is made out of rock, according
right.
to the evolution worldview.
How do you know that?
No. Because we actually have revelation from God that tells us how it really did happen. He created the world, and there are far too many problems.
Okay, see, I have no problem with you believing that, and I have no problem with you promoting that in a church or in a religion class, but if that's the way you're going to teach science and you're going to do it with my tax dollars, I have a big problem with that.
Well, I have a big problem with my tax dollars and your tax dollars going to tell the kids that they all evolved from a rock, that the Big Bang is what created everything from nothing. That's what they're teaching. Nothing exploded.
Well, no, it was a singularity. It wasn't nothing.
Well, where did the singularity come from? And what do they say? They say nothing.
Well, that's one of the
magazine of 2002 in a New American magazine. Alan Guth, a famous scientist, has been writing about this for some time. He says everything came from nothing.
And that's inconsistent with my understanding of the general theory of relativity and the theories on the Big Bang. But B, so what? I mean, there's an enormous amount of evidence that the universe has been expanding for 13.8 billion years. You're trying to suggest that it's only, what, 6,000 years old?
6,000 years old, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And there's lots of evidence that supports that. I was just talking to Bill Nye at an event he did at the University of Florida. Bill Nye brings up the human population being a little more than 7.1 billion today. And in 1964, when he was at the World's Fair, it just crossed the 3 billion mark.
Right.
When it's an exponential growth curve.
Right.
It's very easy to do the math.
It has been an exponential growth curve ever.
Today, it goes back 4,400 years.
except for the fact that the reason why we have the exponential growth curve is because in 1865, Colonel Drake drilled the first commercial oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania.
That's not why we have the exponential growth, no matter what.
We're creating food out of oil. We're doing it all over the world. We're transporting, you know, food with oil. We're fertilizing the whole Green Revolution was based on
the exponential growth will happen no matter what.
Okay. So,
well, I mean, just do the math. Mathematics makes it very simple. Trace it backwards. It started 4,400.
All right. So this is the kind of stuff that you want to teach kids as science.
Now, what's interesting is I'm not the one advocating that the public school system teach this, because that is science.
We're not talking about public school system here. We're talking about homeschooling that is funded. In these states that offer vouchers, that is funded with money that would otherwise only go to public schools.
Why are you
funded with taxpayer dollars?
The other side. Why won't you say, you're right, I'm forcing you, Eric, to pay for my view to be taught? You can't.
Well, because it's not my view. It's science.
13 billion years ago. That's not science. That's a historical idea, but it's not science.
No, Eric, it is science. I hate to break this to you, but science, you know, one of the principal tenets of science is that you never speak or rarely speak in absolute certainties. You speak in the context of, you know, this seems to be the, I mean, it used to be that they thought the universe, when I was in school, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they said, you know, the universe is 15 billion years old. Now they've got it fine tuned down to 13.8 billion. You're always, you know, fine tuning these things, but science doesn't declare certainty the way that religion does. You're teaching religion, not science.
You're saying science can't be certain about gravity.
Science can't be certain about anything. That's one of the core tenets of science is that certainty is, you know, essentially unscientific.
Right. So
everything is always open to question.
Whereas
religion, which is not at all scientific, is all about certainty. You know, hey, God said this. That's it. You don't have to think about it anymore. Now go on with your life.
No, here's what's going on, Tom. Science says we should question everything. But what they don't let you question is the evolution paradigm. Despite the fact, and I could give you hundreds of examples.
Well, what science doesn't let you question is the cockamamie idea that has only really been around since the 1880s that the universe is only 6,000 years old. That's, you know, scientifically, that's both stupid and demonstrably wrong.
How come the magnetic field is getting weaker, putting a maximum age of 25,000 years on it? Comets only last less than 10,000 years, and we've still got comets going around our solar system. How come we've got the human population at 7 billion instead of exponentially more than that right now? The truth is, the science, the math, what we really see happening today, does not support millions of
these things
of
you're throwing out, Eric,
that's
are not.
Why we talk about this and educate people.
Are neither accurate nor scientific.
It's very scientific. Why? How come there are 20, I think, 6 doctorate degree professor level teachers at Liberty University, since you mentioned Liberty, let alone the.
Because Liberty University lets you in without even having a GED.
So basically, if they don't believe in evolution, then they're stupid. That's what you're saying.
I'm saying that they can't. I would not want a scientist
that about 60% of Americans
who doesn't believe in evolution
60% of Americans
doing my science.
So 60% of Americans that believe that God created the earth in the last 10,000 years, they're just
60% of Americans are not going to have a shot at being scientists or engineers. And the fact that you're trying to expand that number is really tragic, I think.
Engineers don't use the evolution theory. Doctors don't use the evolution theory.
No, but they use the scientific. They use scientific principles.
The fundamental questions of life.
And they use science.
It's not part. Yeah, exactly. They use science, and evolution is not part of science. So why we would let a bunch of people? Why would we be upset about?
Eric, I'm leaving you with the last word, which you just had. Eric Hovind, creationtoday.org. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you think? Should we be using our tax dollars to fund homeschool education that the world is 6,000 years old? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nate Sweet is on the line with us, producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
How's it going, Tom?
Also, I should say, international television star.
Not a star just yet. I guess the...
Hey, you've been on my program. You're a star.
Well... I appreciate it.
Okay, yeah. Don't contradict the boss. Okay. on our TV show tonight. Yeah, you won't be a star. I'm not that kind of boss. On our TV show tonight, we're going to start out with Papantonio.
Right. We're going to be talking about lawyers, guns, and money with Mike Papantonio. We're going to be talking about the one-year anniversary of the Newtown Massacre and what's been happening with the gun control efforts since then. Have they succeeded? Have they not? What can we look forward to in the future over the next coming year in regards to gun control? We'll be talking about continuing Republican obstruction in the Senate. They forced the confirmation hearings of Nina Pollard, Obama's nominee to the D.C. Circuit Court, to go on for 30 hours. She was finally confirmed last night at 1 in the morning, so we'll be touching on that, whether or not things have changed since the nuclear option. And we will also be talking about the Murray Ryan budget deal with PAP and get his take on it. You know, there are a lot of people that are happy that it's a compromise budget, but it preserves sequester and it preserves austerity.
Now, did I see a headline that said Harry Reid said we'll stay in session until Christmas, through Christmas if we have to, if the Republicans keep this up?
I have not seen that headline, but I am glad that Harry Reid is sticking to his guns this time around. He's shown a lot of strength in the Senate over the past couple months, and it's encouraging to see.
Yeah, he has. I'm very impressed by it too. I think the entire country is just like waking up and basically waking up and puking. It's like, we've got this Bush hangover. We spent 8 years, just drinking straight vodka, 24/7. And then the first couple of years of the Obama administration, we were just kind of in a daze, and now we're waking up going, whoa. Anyhow, that's probably a terrible metaphor, but the Pope is a lefty.
I think he's more than a lefty. He's borderline socialist from what some of his arguments about economic.
Borderline. I mean, Jesus was a socialist. Jesus was a communist, actually. He was a communalist. The entire community, when he told Judas to go, pay the guy off, they went to the common purse. Everybody pooled their goods and belongings together. These guys were communists.
Well, I don't know if the Pope will be comfortable calling himself a communist, but he has spoken out pretty strongly against economic inequality.
And against capitalism.
Directly against capitalism. It seems like he's directly speaking out against, unrestricted capitalism that we've seen since the Reagan era. And he's done that again with this message for the World Day of Peace.
So you guys are putting together a great little list of the best of the Pope's quotes that we can put up on full screen graphics and argue with Neil.
He's been spewing some awesome stuff for the past couple weeks, so we'll have some stuff in there. See how Neil, who's generally spoken out as a pretty conservative Catholic, can grapple with that.
Mm-hmm. It should be an entertaining conversation.
And, speaking of the Pope, he's sort of become Pope at the right time, because we'll also be talking to Neil about how the millennial generation is the most progressive generation, really, that we've had since the greatest generation during World War II.
And I think for the same reasons.
Right.
I think Great Depressions produce progressive generations.
Yeah.
Real simple. In fact, it's a core principle in my book, The Crash of 2016. Nate, you are a millennial, right?
I am.
Uh-huh. Say proof. Nate Sweet. You are my proof that the universe is 4,000 years old, because I have one anecdote. Anyhow, Nate Sweet. Thanks a lot, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll be back. 20 minutes past the hour. Talk media for the sane among us. It's the Tom Harbin Program. Welcome back. And, so creationists are, Bobby Jindal has given them money, and 11 states altogether, and they're trying to get, money in all the states. The people who put this together is called Accelerated Christian Education, this one. I'm going to sneeze. Hang on just a second. Excuse me. It's that time of year, I guess. Anyhow, the people who put this thing together, it's called Accelerated Christian Education, claim that their curriculum is used in 192 countries and 6,000 schools worldwide. That's frightening. Again, I have no objection to this kind of stuff being taught in Sunday school. It's just fine. It's the appropriate place for it. In some other Sabbath day, sacred day school, somebody is being taught that you shouldn't wear clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric. Or somebody else is being taught, in some other religion, is being taught that You know, that it's a violation of the First Commandment to have a picture of the prophet. And somebody else is being taught that, you know, the universe grew out of the navel of, oh, it wasn't Shiva, who was it? Whoever it was. Anyhow, you know, out of a lotus flower that came out of the navel of the head god. And somebody else is being taught that, well, maybe there's not even a god. Like the Buddhists, right? But Buddha really, you know, he was enlightened. He knew that everything is all one thing and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like, I don't have a problem with any of that stuff being taught. Somebody's, you know, probably teaching their kids about the flying spaghetti monster, although I'm guessing everybody does it tongue-in-cheek, but who knows? But I just have to play this for you. You can play audio through the board from my computer, right? Machino? Okay, we had a computer crash earlier today. This is Megyn Kelly on Fox News. Listen to this. This is from yesterday.
Move on, because I want to get to this other topic. So in Slate, they have a piece on .com, Santa Claus should not be a white man anymore. And when I saw this headline, I kind of laughed, and I said, oh, this is so ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa, you know? And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids. Okay, I wanted to get that straight. But Jedediah, when I read the piece, the author...
So anyhow, then she gets into, you know, how the author of this piece grew up black and said, you know, there was no Santa there for me. I mean, I just kind of felt like I was on the outside. And her first guest, and therefore lets her play Santa with a penguin, and her first guest says, you know, I don't have such a problem with the penguin thing. I think, you know, that's kind of a cool idea. And you read the piece and you really get it, that it must be tough growing up black in a world where Santa is white. And then Megyn Kelly comes back with this.
You know, I mean, Jesus was a white man too, but you know, it's like he was a historical figure. I mean, that's a verifiable fact, as is Santa. I just want the kids watching to know that.
Yes.
But my point is, how do you just revise it?
Okay, so now I really don't believe that Megyn Kelly's a smart woman. I don't believe that she's asserting that Santa was a historical figure. She's saying for you kids. I mean, this is Fox News. They're going out of their way to make sure that if there's a 5-year-old in the room who's watching TV, that they're, you know, that their illusions of Santa Claus are not shattered. And they, you know, I actually remember when I was around six or seven. It's one of my earliest memories. My parents took me for a ride, because I had three younger brothers at that point in time, so they took me out alone, take me for a ride. It was just before Christmas time, to tell me that there was no Santa, and invite me to help them organize Christmas for my two younger brothers. And I think they figured out, they thought that I had figured it out by then, but I hadn't. And I remember being shattered by, what, there's no Santa? I mean, just shattered. And you wonder what kind of, you know, lifetime consequence that revelation has for some kids. What, my parents have been lying to me all these years? My entire culture has been lying to me? I think I'll join the SDS. I mean, you know, it's like, is there a cause-effect relationship? I don't know. But in any case, Megyn Kelly, you know, she's trying to make sure the kids are not hurt by this. I think, frankly, kids who are old enough to consume Fox News or talk radio probably have already figured this out. I'm not so worried about it, frankly, right now. But in any case, so I don't think that she's asserting so much that Santa actually is a definite historical figure. Maybe St. Nicholas. But here's the thing. St. Nicholas was a Turk. Turks have dark skin. You wouldn't call them African American, but Turkey is, and Turkey is arguably at the very southern part of Europe rather than the northern part of Africa. But Jesus was born in the Galilee, which is like the south part of the Middle East, which is like right abutting to Egypt, which is northern part of Africa. And Jesus was almost certainly not an Ashkenazi Jew. He was a Sephardic. He was almost certainly somebody who looked Semitic, who looked more like, you know, the modern day Iraqis and Afghans and people who are who in some places, like on Fox News, would be described as people of color. Not necessarily dark, dark color, but color. So what's the deal? Why do white people feel so strongly that they have to hang on to white Santa Claus? What's wrong with acknowledging, A, that Santa Claus could be any color for anybody because he's not a historical figure. He's a cultural creation. And B, that Jesus, who, even the historical evidence for the existence of Jesus as he stands, and some would argue is fairly weak, but whatever, that Jesus wasn't at least a Northern European WASP, the way that he's characterized in so many crucifixes and paintings and things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, can't we now in 2013 all grow up and say teaching creationism to kids is child abuse and, you know, and Jesus wasn't white? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, Bob in Marcells, Illinois. I think you're making one of the most important points, Bob. Hey, welcome to the program.
And I'll tell you something. Creationist scientists and scientists from Liberty University don't scare me too much. But what really scares me is what our former president did to the Justice Department with civil servants. They can't get fired, at least not easily. They don't serve at the beck and call of the president. And the Justice Department was loaded up with these people that were from a law school that didn't say Liberty right on the title, but it was a division of Liberty University. And it just got loaded with them.
Oh, I know. And there were two young women who were, I just remember them as young blondes. And I don't mean that in anything other than that's what I remember. Who had done some pretty remarkable things in the Bush administration, taken some positions that were just breathtakingly stupid. Monica Goodling was one of them. With regard to law, I'm sorry, I can't remember the details of it, but I do remember the whole Liberty University lawyers have stalked the Bush administration. And I'm with you, Bob. It scares the heck out of me, too. Thank you for the call. Darren in Darrington, Washington. Perfect,
hey,
perfect town for your name, Darren. Hey, what's up?
I'm a little nervous. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller, and I was listening to that creationist idiot, and I've followed him on the internet for a couple of years now, and I can't get over how dumb he is. I tried to write down my thoughts, and I'm going to do it as fast as I can.
Okay.
Okay, so first of all, the 6,000-year, this is just general information, the fact that he believes that the Earth was created only 6,000 years ago means that he believes that the Earth was created after the invention of glue and after the domestication of the dog. Second thing,
right.
I disagree strongly with the concept of a Christian child. Richard Dawkins made a very, very compelling argument for we should never, ever call any child a Christian child or a Muslim child or a Buddhist child. It'd be the equivalent of saying, well, this child is a socialist. They have never, or a capitalist or what have you, they have never had the opportunity to take in the information. They are simply not mature enough to take in the information, chop it up, look at it, and decide for themselves what they are. So, you know, if you ever hear somebody say this is a Christian child, as opposed to saying this is a child of Christian parents, do me a favor. Hit him in the head with a pan. Next thing.
Your point is really well taken. Your point is really well taken. And let me, you know, that's the A. Here's the B that comes from it. This is an effort to convert children to Christianity so that when they do become of the age of choice, the amount of information and the nature of the information that they will be so heavily skewed toward Christianity that they will choose to become fundamentalist Christians.
Well, it wasn't a Jesuit who said, you give me a child to the age of seven and I'll give you the man?
Yeah, well, I don't remember who it was, but it was some famous famous figure, but long time ago, yeah.
I'll try and make it as fast as possible because I know you got other people on the line.
Oh boy,
everything that that guy uses today comes from science. His phone comes from science. His car comes from science. Science works. Engines run. Planes fly. That's why science works the way it is. The problem that I have with, that I've always had with religious people, I've gone to many religious schools. My mother really wanted me to have a relationship with God, kept pushing me into Christian schools, and I just kept getting thrown out of them because I was one of the few kids in the school who actually read the Bible. And the problem is that when you seed your mind and your reasoning faculties and say God did it, that ceases all scientific exploration. We would not have anything if their points of if their mindset was allowed to take root. And the last thing that because I know you got a whole bunch of people, the last thing I wanted to say was there's a rant by Neil deGrasse Tyson on the internet when he was at the Skeptics Conference. He does this really great rap about fundamentalism and Saudi Arabia, because for many years Saudi Arabia was the crossroads of scientific inquiry, mathematics, great strides through mathematics.
Yeah, 1,000 years ago.
Was made, 1,000 years ago from, I think, I want to say the year 900 to 110 AD. There was that 300-year period, and there was a guy, there was a lot of reasons why it fell, but there was a guy there named, I want to say, Al-Ghazali, who was a Muslim cleric who was basically the Augustine of the Muslim world. He codified a whole bunch of Muslim writings and basically said, you know, here's how you be a good Muslim. You know, this is how you have to live your life to be a good Muslim. But one of the things he put down was that manipulating numbers was the work of the devil. And that after 110 AD, that completely undercut the feet out of all scientific inquiry and all scientific research. And Saudi Arabia and the Muslim world has not recovered since.
You're right.
Fundamentalism is dangerous.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, very well said, Darren. Thank you very much. In fact, hang on just a minute. Let me see if I can push this button successfully. I'm going to put you on hold because Shano just said that he wants you to be the guy who gets the book today, an autographed copy of Crash of 2016, my new book. So Darren is on line one, actually. It's unusual to have line one be line one, but there he is. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, on line two.
Hey, Tom, good to chat with you again. I was on a couple of days ago. It boggles the mind that you have all these fundamentalists, as Darren pointed out, who don't want to believe in science. And I'll give you a perfect example. When Ronald Reagan came down with Alzheimer's, he was never for stem cell research, nor was Nancy. As soon as he came down with Alzheimer's, all of a sudden they're a big proponent of science, stem cell research. We need science to save us. If, in fact, they are true believers in God, then science should have no part because God's destiny would determine what the outcome would be.
Well, if they believe God to be a God who is, A, omnipotent, and, B, actually answers intercessory prayer. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's lots of variations on that.
Yeah, jumping off on the creationist that was on your program, I jumped in the middle of a conversation. Has he ever heard of carbon dating and the carbon isotope?
Yeah, I'm sure that I've seen their explanations for that. They've got it all figured out. You know, the machines are miscalibrated or something like that. I don't know. And Gary, I got to move along, but thank you. Excellent point. Oh, you wanted to mention something about the multi-universe theory?
I was just going to say, with regards to he was talking about the Big Bang, there are two schools of thoughts out there, real briefly. One is the Big Bang theory that the universe was created in an instant. Another one is that, and this has been talked about by Alan Guth, who he referenced, there's two schools of thought, and they're in the process of actually testing which one is the correct theory. The other is called the multiverse theory, where they're basically almost an infinite number of universes. They call them brains. They're basically relatively flat. And on occasion, every, I forget how many hundreds or billions of years or so, these universes bang into each other. That creates the energy for what appears to be a Big Bang. Now, they're at the cusp of actually testing which one of these is correct.
Right. Yeah, and last week, I think it was Our Geeky Science, or it was maybe it was a week ago today anyway, I was talking about this new study that they've done looking at ancient background radiation. And it looks like you're familiar with the bubble theory, the foam theory, the multiverse as foam as opposed to as planes. It looks like the outer edges of our universe expanded in ways that were not consistent with there being nothing around us. That in fact what we were doing was bumping into other bubbles. And so the outer edges of our universe sort of are indented like a golf ball. And not quite like that, but they didn't use that metaphor in the article. But, you know, they pushed up against other things, and so there are these, like, dents around the edges. And so it seems like, you know, our universe is one among many.
Right. One other quick point that you mentioned. They have actually mapped out the radiation of the universe. It is in total agreement with all the equations that they have come forth with. So. Yeah. This is science for people to say that, oh, the Earth has only been here for 6,000 years.
Yeah, it's just wrong. Yeah, Gary, thank you for the call. Bill in Northampton, Mass. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, Tom, I'm so glad you're in this conversation today. It seems like only one theme, but it's a really powerful theme. And I was just taken in your conversation with this person who identified as a creationist with how close you and he actually came to having a real conversation, especially when we got to the part where I was kind of saying, gee, I wish Tom would say, well, okay, so you have a before man. What about a before God? I know that's a classic sort of tedious conversation about understanding.
His answer would be God was eternal.
Right.
I mean, I've had that debate before with these guys.
Right. Well, but the other part about it, the other part about it, though, is the part where it's heartrending to find people who are so certain that they're not compelled by the mystery of uncertainty.
Yeah, that's, well, and that was my point, is that science deals always in uncertainty and the edges, and you know, and tries to push to the edges of uncertainty to resolve uncertainty, whereas religion will brook no uncertainty. Religion is, this is the way it is, period, end of conversation. And those are two very, very different things. And I remember, who was the famous pop science guy? We had his wife on after he died. Anyway, he talked about how just, you know, as a child, looking through a telescope into the universe was his equivalent of a religious experience. And it's mine. I mean, this just, you know, the great mystery. We, you know, the stuff we don't know. Looking at these pictures from the Hubble telescope, it's like, wow, you know, this is incredible stuff. Bill, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WHMP. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Carl Sagan was his name. He'd been on our program, a proud atheist, and his wife. I did a long interview with her, which is over at PodJockey.com. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Gene in Santa Barbara, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Well, I got a great idea. And Gene Tyburn's my name, and I like to think of myself as a poet. In any case, I've had a wonderful idea, floated it, and I think you're going to love it, and I'd like you to do something about it because you have the connections to do it. You know, they've just found a planet three times the size of Jupiter. You know that, Tom?
I didn't know that.
Yes. Well,
are you talking about the one that is like all the math is inconsistent on it? They can't figure out why it's where it is relative to that star?
It's spectacular. It's gigantic.
Yeah.
And I think we ought to call it Mandela.
Mandela. Oh, name it after Nelson Mandela, you mean.
Right. So he'll never be forgotten.
Uh-huh.
That universe, that planet is going to become, you know, that planet's going to be mentioned for the rest of our existence.
Right.
And that would be an honor sufficient and equal to his saving several millions of people by stopping a civil war.
Yeah. Or stopping the apartheid movement.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, that, you know how that could have ended. And and I think it's an honor befitting him. And I'd like to see you might decide to mention it a few times and see if we can get something going like that.
Okay. Well, Gene, I'm not adopting that as my idea, but you just shared it with millions of people, and hopefully others will. I think it's a great idea. I don't object to it at all. I think it's a great suggestion. Thank you, Gene. Thanks for sharing that. Randall in Howe, Texas. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I just like that Mr. I like to say bovine, and I know he's not here to defend himself, but
yeah, let's not
he reminds me of a bovine. Well, in Africa, these archaeological finds, they found a human remains. They identified it as about a 4 foot tall female. They carbon dated the skull at 4.5 million years.
Right.
So.
But see, what if God was just like messing with the scientists' brains by miscalibrating the machine or changing how radiocarbon isotopes decay or whatever? And so that number is just meaningless.
Well, okay, the Inuit or whatever Eskimos in Alaska that came across the land bridge, their tribal communities can trace their ancestry back 11,000 years during the times that a woolly mammoth was still around.
Yeah, they have the stories.
They hunted woolly mammoths. And that was 11,000 years ago.
Yeah, but again, you know, they could just be wrong. Or it could be that God created them 6,000 years ago, complete with the stories. Do you get how weird this stuff is? I mean, this is what they're teaching our kids.
Yeah, well, first of all, here's a real good philosophy to me. Religious beliefs, no matter what belief, atheists, everyone and everything involved should not be mixed with politics, because when you mix any kind of religion, beliefs of any other group of people with politics equals war.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And Thomas Jefferson would have absolutely agreed with you, which is why he was, absolutely. Thank you, Randall. 7 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Tim in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for all you do. I really appreciate the fact that you don't lose your temper when you're talking to some of these folks and that you have a very level, serious discussion.
Well, I'm trying to role model for all of us because we all have people like this in our families or our workplaces, and it's useful to talk back.
I'd like to comment about the creationist.
Yes, sir.
And what I would like to say is when you have an argument with a creationist who demands or desires or insists that priests be allowed into science classes to preach creationism, they must also be ready to allow a scientist to appear in church on Sunday during Mass on a podium preaching evolution. And if they're not ready for that, they need to shut the hell up about putting priests in science classes. And
that's a good point. Tim, good point. Tim, thank you very much for that. Jeff in Rogers, Arkansas. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Tom. I was just totally amazed about the creationist guy. I mean, 6,000 years ago, got a little yabba-dabba-doo in his history and everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm telling you that he believes it. And there are people all over this country who believe this. And, and I don't have a problem with that. Unless, they're teaching a 10-year-old who wants to grow up and be a rocket scientist. And that 10-year-old is going to have a real problem when he gets into a science class with no foundation or no understanding of scientific principles. And, in fact, the opposite,
Well, I have a problem with the homeschool being abused like that because there's people that are in, like Alaska and stuff that have to depend on because they don't have the resources like that. Mm. And then you have somebody that, if their church believes so greatly in that, well, why don't they fund their own idea?
Yeah, well, I'm with you. And Louise and I homeschooled one of our kids, at least through the last half of her education, or her grade school, would it be grade school education. This was her decision, not ours. In fact, we were a little taken aback when she came to us and said, "That's it, you guys are going to homeschool me." But she did it through an online homeschool, oakmeadow.com, I think was the name of it. And it's a Steiner school, as I recall, a Waldorf school, and it worked really, really well. And she traveled around the world with us, but we weren't trying to teach her how to be religious or anything. I mean, it was a good education. But we also didn't go to the state of Vermont, which is where we lived at the time, and say, you guys should pay for our daughter's education. Because if she had been in the public school, you would be paying for it, so therefore give me a voucher. We didn't do that. We, you know, fortunately, we had the means to pay for her education as homeschooled. And it's just these folks who are saying to the state, to the taxpayers, to you and me, you should pay for me to teach my kid at home. I think it's just wrong. Public schools are free. They should be free. They're out there. We need to expand them and strengthen them. And if somebody wants to homeschool their child, or their home, or the child wants to be homeschooled, I understand that. But I don't think that we should collectively have to pay for it. I'm with you, Jeff, in the pay for it part. Greg in La Follette, Tennessee. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, man. It's a wonderful topic, and I appreciate you using the word child abuse, because I'm in total agreement that it's tantamount. That I even go further. The whole creation, the whole Genesis book is to me is child abuse, to teach children, women are responsible for evil. It starts in my way of thinking, it starts the screw over of fresh, noble, divine minds, and they're turned into these misogynistic creatures. There's a 50-50 chance, but it just happens to be females or beguiled by the serpent. So they get off to a great start. They're knocked down a peg. And dominion, this idea of dominion. Mm. We people are so obsessed with taking over because we, after all, have dominion over everything. Genesis is an absolute, at least, you know what kills me about our society? At least they tell us that Santa Claus is nonsense. Somebody should tell us that Sunday school, sorry, by 12 years old, we were just kidding. It's, yeah. What kills me is that people go through this life, adults, with their Sunday school eyes. They never rearrange their map of the cosmos and of their soul, and they look through the world with those same Sunday school eyes. When I was 10 years old, I smelled something rotten in Denmark with these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they're simply allegory. And we have it's this idea, the most unattractive thing of Christianity will always be that it's right. It's always, the Tibetan monks, the first thing they tell their students is, we might be wrong, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's never this absolute belief that everything's absolute and there's no other way to God.
Yeah, well, Buddhism is unique in that regard. And also, I believe Buddhism is the only religion that has never had a war declared in its name. And I suspect that there's a relationship between those two things. The other thing about Genesis, Greg, there's two creation stories in Genesis, and they're different. And there's some really, really good scholarship on this. I am of the opinion that one of those creation stories was the story of an old hunter-gatherer tribe, and the other was the creation story of a later agricultural tribe. And that the creation story of the old hunter-gatherer tribe was a warning about doing agriculture. Don't go do agriculture. This is a very kind of Daniel Quinn, Ishmael worldview, but I believe that you can find this in the Bible. And it's the story of Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, that Cain was Abel was the shepherd. You know, he was part hunter-gatherer, part pastoralist. And Cain was the farmer. The farmer kills the hunter-gatherer. This is a warning, and then by the way, goes off to the next village to marry a woman, to start a family. Well, where did the next village come from if Adam and Eve were the first people? I mean, there's some logic problems here. But so, and therefore, it's just a creation story for that tribe. It's not the story of the creation of all humanity. It's the unique story of the creation of that tribe. And every tribe has a story like that, of how that tribe was created. Greg, thank you for the call. But anyway, I just find that whole thing fascinating, and I'm now wandering into comparative religion and, Daniel Quinn and Elaine Pagels and all, my favorite writers. But we will continue this and more right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Is the Pope a lefty? Really? I think the Pope is a lefty. We don't have a guest on this, do we? No. Yeah, the Pope is a lefty. No doubt about it. Okay, Liberty University. There's a couple of things that I wanted to get into with you here. This is... In fact, actually, we've got a bunch of them. We'll continue the conversation about creationism and creation science, and nobody has raised the a response to Megyn Kelly's Fox News assertion that Jesus was white and so is Santa Claus. Period. Historical fact. I guess it depends on how you define white, because. Let's not go down that rabbit hole. Anyway, it's actually this whole thing of racial definitions. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that Jesus was not a Northern European, which is how he has characterized, assuming that there was a historical Jesus. He was not a Northern European. Unless he did a really good job of fooling Mary and Joseph at birth, before birth, somehow. I mean, or maybe Mary and Joseph fooled everybody else or whatever. But, everybody thought that they were from the region, right, from the Galilee, where people have fairly dark skin and black hair and, dark eyes, brown eyes. And Santa Claus actually started out as a Turkish saint. And, again, so I'm curious about your thoughts on that. Although every single line on the board is full right now, I think. Oh, there's one line empty. So if somebody wanted to call in. But then there's, for a long time we've been talking about racial demographics. And this is the conversation that certainly they like to have on the right. Oh, look at all these African Americans who voted for Barack Obama. And that kind of thing. But the fact of the matter is that there are generational demographics coming along. And in my book, The Crash of 2016, my newest book, there's some extensive conversation about this. About... I credit Neil Howe and William Strauss, the authors of The Fourth Turning, with introducing me to this concept. That every four generations, we just go through a whole brand new cycle. And every fourth, it's like there's these four generations. There's the generation that experiences a crash and a war. Now, you could argue that they've been out of order. That we had the Afghan and Iraqi wars and then we had the crash. Or you could argue that there's a war coming, a world war that has not yet come that is going to come out of the crash when the crash gets really bad in 2016. Whatever it may be, anyhow, there's a generation that experiences war and a crash. And that generation, because of their experience, they become fairly frugal and they have a worldview that produces children, their children, who are the children of the war and the depression. And those children for this millennial generation have not yet been born or are just starting to be born. But they certainly haven't come of age. But they had come of age. This was the generation that, you know, was being born in the 30s and 40s and like that, 30s and 40s. That generation, then, they're the slow and steady builders. So the first generation experiences crash and war. The second generation says, okay, enough of this. We don't want any more crashes. We don't want any more wars. We want stability. And they become conservative in the classic sense, in that they just simply, you know, nose to the grindstone. You know, the when I was a kid, we referred to them as the silent generation. Tom Brokaw started calling them the greatest generation, my father's generation. They were kids during World War II. They were children during the Great Depression. And then that generation, their children, which would be me, which is the boomer generation, their children, and arguably part of, you know, the Gen X, their children say, you know, that careful builder stuff and 40 years at the same job and all, you know, don't complain and all that, that didn't get you very far, did it? We want to figure out what's the meaning of life. And we want to change the world for the better. And so you get this idealist generation. And in some ways, radical generation that just pushes and gets very political, and they're out in the streets and they're changing things. And you know, the last time around, it was Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau and you know, et cetera. And in this generation, it was the SDS and people experimenting with LSD, the Timothy Learys and the Ram Dasses and the Beatles and the Maharishi and the whole thing, okay? And then that generation gives birth to a generation, which are the people who came into and took control of the business world about 15 to 20 years ago. They give birth to a generation that then says, you know, our parents spent all their time, you know, gazing at their navels or getting high or protesting in the streets, and it didn't get them anywhere. Screw that. I'm going to get rich. This is the fourth generation, okay? So the first generation experiences war and depression. They give birth to a generation that just carefully builds things because they want stability. They give birth to a generation that says that stability was nice, thank you very much, but it's boring. So they give birth to the rabble-rouser generation. And the rabble-rouser generation then gives birth to a generation that says, you know, that rabble-rousing didn't get you anywhere. Let's get rich. Let's make some money. And that's the generation of the roaring 20s. And that's the generation that ran our businesses, that was in their 30s, 20s, 30s, early 40s, running our businesses over the last decade, two decades, decade and a half. And that generation, because their motto, that fourth generation, their motto is greed is good. That would be the people in their 30s and 40s by and large right now. They screw things up so bad that they provoke another Great Depression. Hey, let's do away with Glass-Steagall. That sounds like a great idea. And along comes another Great Depression. And the cycle starts all over again. So, and four generations, each generation is about 20 years. Four generations, about 80 years. So 80 years ago, we had the Great Depression in World War II. 80 years before that, there was the Great Depression of 1857 and the Civil War. 80 years before that was the Great Depression of 1700 and the American Revolution. And you can take this all the way back to the War of the Roses. And before that, in fact, Strauss and Howe in their book take it back to the 1400s. And it probably goes back before that. So the millennial generation, the kids who are being born now, or not being born now, who are the young people, the teenagers now, and the people in their young, early 20s, are this incredibly liberal generation. They're the generation that experienced the war and the depression. They're the generation that was my grandfather who was the socialist. who gave birth to my father, the conservative who gave birth to me, the liberal who gave birth to my kids, who are the workers out there, and then they give birth, if I had grandchildren, to the one, which I don't, to the ones who are the liberals.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this is really bad news for the modern Republican Party. We'll get into that. Welcome back. And for a minute there, I thought I had two dead trackpads. Pat, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network in the Dalles, Oregon. Hey, Pat, how are you?
Oh, good. How are you, Tom?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling. You wanted to talk about religion and how it started?
Yeah, this is just a theory.
Mm-hmm.
The way I think it all happened was a bunch of disgruntled old men got together way back when, and they were trying to figure out the best way to control the people. And so what they did was they decided to, you know, get all the people of like thought together and write up a big volume and call it the Bible, and you know, with all the rules and regulations in it.
Mm-hmm.
And but their main thought was the way to control people is through hatred and fear, and ignorance, of course. But the thing about it is that I notice is these Kookalooka Tea Party people, you know, every day when you turn, if you turn on Fox News, which I seldom do, that's what they spout is hatred and fear. You know, we're supposed to fear people, you know, Muslims and so forth. They're terrorists. All the Muslims are terrorists. Yeah, and, you know, and they're ready to go to war at the drop of a hat. And they hate anybody who doesn't agree with them. You know, I just think that it's a control thing. Religion is a control thing.
I think so, too, although I would say that that was the second stage. I think the first stage was a bunch of people looked up at the sky and saw some lightning come down and strike a tree or maybe strike Ralph. And they said, what was that? Where did it come from? And, oh, well, that must be the gods up on top of the clouds, you know, hammering anvils or something. You know, it was an attempt to explain natural phenomena that was inexplicable given the state of scientific knowledge at the time.
Well, you're kinder than I am, yeah.
And that, but see, that's the thing. If you take that, then, if you take a consensus about, you know, okay, you know, that stuff coming up out of the volcanoes, that must be hell. And those up in the clouds, there must be something above the clouds, that must be heaven. And, you know, what's that face on the moon and all this? If you start taking on that, you know, building a religion around that, and then you say, and I'm the high priest, right? It's like, you know, I when I lived in Germany, I learned that the whole Christmas tree thing came from on the shortest day of the year, the high priest, the old Germanic high priest, pre-Christian, would find the highest tree on the highest point in the local hill, and on the shortest day of the year, they'd set that sucker on fire. They would set that tree on fire. And this was to reignite the sun. And the next day, the days would start getting longer, and all the people would say, he did it again. And for another year, the guy gets to be priest, right? Gets to be in charge. And then it becomes that power thing. And that's why they built these Stonehenge kind of things. So they knew what day was the shortest day and the longest day. That's why they were all obsessed with the solstices, was because they could use that. You know, the longest day, they could say, okay, you know, the evil forces are going to start arriving, and the days are going to start getting shorter and shorter because the monsters are eating the sun. And when the days reach a certain point, I'm going to fight them back by setting a tree on fire. And that's, you know, and the shortest day of the year is just happens to be in the neighborhood of Christmas, you know, within 2 or 3 days of it. Anyhow, Pat, interesting theory. Thank you for sharing your theory with me and listening to mine. I appreciate the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Minutes past the hour. Okay, so I was going through this whole generational thing with probably far more detail than you wanted or needed, but let me give you some numbers that I think are fascinating. This is from the Pew Research Center, and I believe, let's see, Jonathan Chait wrote this, and it was on the Daily Intelligencer. Unfortunately, the printout does not show the website, so I'm not sure where this came from. But maybe Danielle can track that down and just yell it at me while I'm on the air so I can give them credit. But basically, if you turned 18 under President Roosevelt, then you voted Democratic. If you turned 18 under Truman or Eisenhower, it was about 50-50 under Truman, under Eisenhower, as you voted Republican. This is my dad. My dad turned 18 under, well, actually, he turned 18 probably under Roosevelt or early Truman. Anyhow, if you turned 18 under Kennedy, it was about 50-50. If you turned 18 under Nixon, you were most likely voted Democratic. If you turned 18 under Ford and Carter, you most likely voted Republican. This would include the Reagan so-called landslide. Oh, this came from the Washington Post. Thank you, Danielle. If you turned 18 under the presidency of Bill Clinton, you voted Democratic. And if you turned 18 under the presidency of Bush and Obama, you virtually certainly voted Democratic. And tan boxes represent years in which an age group was roughly equal to the national average. Okay. Anyway, it's fascinating. Jonathan Chait wrote this piece called "The Millennial Generation: Our Liberal Future." So, but you don't have to be somebody who just turned 18 to have this worldview, because the Pope is out there. Pope Francis, his latest rant is about CEO salaries. I mean, he's going after what's his name? Who's the president of Goldman Sachs, who said that he's doing God's work. Yeah, I can't remember his name either. That's reassuring when Shane can't remember and Jim can't remember. I know I haven't lost it. In any case, Lloyd Blankfein, I think was his name. When Lloyd Blankfein said that he was doing God's work, being the head of Goldman Sachs and taking all that money, Pope Francis says, no, not so fast. Pope Francis attacked mega salaries and big bonuses on Thursday, saying in the first peace message of his pontificate that they are symptoms of an economy based on greed and inequality. This is from Reuters. He called for more sharing of the wealth among people and the nations to narrow the gap between rich and poor. This is a quote from the Pope. The grave financial and economic crises of the present time have pushed man to seek satisfaction, happiness, and security in consumption and earnings out of all proportions to the principles of a sound economy. See, the Pope, in a sound economy, the Pope is lecturing us on economics, which, of course, is going to make Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh's heads explode. The Pope says the succession series of economic crises should lead to a timely rethinking of our models of economic development and to a change in lifestyles. This is the guy who says, no more carrying me around on your shoulders, you know, six guys with the papal throne, no more Pope Mobile. He bought a used car from one of his buddies in the Cardinal College or whatever it was, and he sneaks out at night in this used car and is making the palace guard freak out. And this Pope is a good guy, I think. I mean, you know, he still doesn't want to ordain women, and he still, you know, the Catholic Church still has, I mean, it's still the Catholic Church, right? They have positions which are not, some positions which are not exactly modern compared to some other churches, but still, this is amazing stuff. And he's right. Bryce Covert, writing over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, a growing share of the country's jobs pay less than $15 an hour, replacing high-wage jobs. This is from an Alliance for Just Society that issued this new report. A number of jobs and occupations that pay a median wage below $15 an hour grew by 3.6 million over the last 4 years, increasing by about 3%. During that same time, the number of jobs that pay above that level fell by 4 million. So we just went from a whole bunch of people making more than 15 bucks an hour, 4 million people, 8 million people in total, making more than $8 an hour to making less than $15 an hour, more than $15 an hour to less than $15. And then they go on to say there are 7 job seekers for every protected job opening that paid above $15 an hour. Since the end of the recession, most of the jobs added have paid less than $13.88 an hour. Middle-class jobs have practically vanished. If the minimum wage had kept up with inflation, it would be over $10 an hour. And if we had kept up with increasing worker productivity, the minimum wage would be over 20, or the average wage would be over $20 an hour. So the question, why are the millennials liberal? Why are the young people coming up more progressive? And one of the ways, by the way, that you know that they are, is that in Texas, you can vote with a gun owner ID, with a concealed weapon carry permit, but you cannot vote with a student ID. And Texas is not unique in this. These kinds of laws proposed by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and others, these kinds of laws have been put into place in all kinds of Republican states all over the country to make it hard, impossible, whatever, for college students to vote, to make it easy for old white guys with a shotgun to vote. Why? Because they know that the college students are liberals. And it wasn't always that way. It's not. This is a generational thing. This is not just a college student thing. And these young people are coming of age, and they're coming of age with eyes wide open, which is causing the modern Republican Party. I mean, they're counseling their old white guys on how to talk to women. And don't talk about legitimate rape anymore, okay? They need to be talking to them and to people of color. Rand Paul, really?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now they need to be counseling them on how to talk to people from the mid-teens to the mid-20s. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very radiolucently ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Colin Powell. Yes, that Colin Powell. In a recent interview with the Puget Sound Business Journal, a former Secretary of State endorsed a single-payer health care system. He said, "I'm not an expert in health care or Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act or however you choose to describe it, but I do know this. I have benefited from that kind of universal health care in my 55 years of public life, and I don't see why we can't do what Europe is doing, what Canada is doing, what Korea is doing, what all those other places are doing." There are a lot of things you can criticize Colin Powell for, the most obvious being his role in hustling the Iraq war to the American people, but he's absolutely right when it comes to single-payer health care. Obamacare is a good start, but there's only so much we can achieve while keeping our privatized health insurance industry alive. The bad, Megyn Kelly. Some people say that the Kelly File host is the rational voice over at Fox so-called news. Those people probably haven't seen what she said during last night during an episode of her show. While discussing a Slate.com article that criticized the popular depictions of Santa Claus as a white man, Kelly both defended the idea that Santa is white and then tried to justify her arguments by pointing out that Jesus Christ was white, too. Check it out.
In Slate, they have a piece on .com, Santa Claus should not be a white man anymore. And when I saw this headline, I kind of laughed, and I said, oh, this is so ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa, you know? And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. Just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change, you know? I mean, Jesus was a white man, too. But, you know, it's like he was a historical figure. I mean, that's a verifiable fact.
Actually, Jesus was not a white man. He was a Middle Eastern man and probably looked more like somebody from modern-day Lebanon than a WASP from New England. All factual inaccuracies aside, though, the real issue here is that Megyn Kelly is actually upset by the idea of Santa not being a white man. I should tell you a lot about the Fox so-called news network and its target audience. And the very, very ugly, Greg Gopman, the CEO of the Silicon Valley startup AngelHack, finds himself embroiled in a controversy today after he posted to Facebook an angry rant attacking the city of San Francisco. According to Gopman, San Francisco is full of degenerates who need to learn their place. He wrote, the difference is, in other cosmopolitan cities, the lower part of society keeps to themselves. They sell small trinkets, beg coyly, stay quiet, and generally stay out of your way. They realize it's a privilege to be in the civilized part of town and view themselves as guests. And that's okay. But in downtown San Francisco, the degenerates gather like hyenas. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how the CEO corporate class sees working Americans and poor Americans. And that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly.
That's mind-bogglingly ugly.
Dame, don't be drinking while fundraising, Anatole says. Yeah, okay. Damon in Westchester, Ohio. Hey, Damon, it says you disagree with me.
Well, I do. I mean, I've been a long-time listener, and I agree with much, you know, a majority, almost all of what you say. But when, you know, two people compare, there are always some things that they're not going to agree on. At some point, I believe I've heard you call yourself a Christian. Is that correct?
I generally, if somebody says, what's your religion, I will say I'm a Christian, yeah.
Okay, and I'm just getting back to the conversation you had before. You know, as a Christian myself, I've heard you made references about science, which, you know, I believe in science. But we also know that not everything that man has theorized and went through the scientific method to prove has proven out to be correct. And,
sure.
I mean, one example,
that's the whole point of science. It's constantly learning new things and proving old things wrong.
Right. It is. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen done by man as an example, you know, we know that diamonds are created by pressure over time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that, I don't know the exact numbers, but the diamonds were created, or however you want to...
Formed, shall we say?
Say that they were established over, you know, millions of years, when man has created diamonds, you know, with machines, which basically kind of eliminates the theory of that amount of time needed to create a diamond.
Why?
Well, man doesn't have to use the same amount of time.
As a natural process, sure. But that doesn't mean that the natural process isn't actually happening.
Well, no, I'm not saying it doesn't actually happen, but what I'm saying is the time could come into question if, you know, the only variable that's different is time, basically.
Well, you know, until we developed jet airplanes, it took, you know, weeks to travel across the continent. And until we developed wagon wheels, it probably took longer than that. I mean, that... I'm not following you. That doesn't mean that we never walked or that jet airplanes don't exist. I'm not following your logic.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, the Bible has many things in it that over time, for instance, it's mentioned civilizations that historians and archaeologists for time didn't believe existed. And then as time has passed and investigation has been done, the Bible has been proven right. And there are a number of, you know, situations like that in the Bible.
Well, you would never say a historian didn't believe something existed, because history isn't a matter of belief. They would say that a historian had never found evidence of. That's a, you know,
well,
history is scientific, at least in theory, and science and religion is not. In religion, you'd say somebody doesn't believe in something. But in history, you would say there's no evidence for something. It's a very different thing.
Well, I did use the word believe, but that's not quite the context that I was meaning to express it in. But
okay. So what is it that we disagree about?
Well, here's a bone that I have to pick with you. I listen to you on a regular basis, and like I say, you say that you're a Christian, and you make comments about things that are in the Old Testament. One example is about shellfish and wearing mixed fabrics.
Right. Yeah. It's all in Leviticus.
Right. Well, the things that are in the Old Testament are things that were done before Christ.
Christ who said, I have not come to abolish the Old Testament, I have come to fulfill it.
Well, the Old Testament prophesizes his coming and his death. So that's the fulfillment. But not in a, in a, in
okay,
whole.
So, so you're saying we can toss out the Old Testament, so there's no reason for Oklahoma to have the Ten Commandments posted, because that's Old Testament stuff.
Well, true.
Instead, it's, they it's, should it's, be posting a list of the Beatitudes, right?
We could do that. I mean, you know, the Old Testament and the whole Bible is about the nature of God. I mean, the nature of God doesn't change in the Bible, but...
The nature of God changes considerably in the Bible. At some points in time, God is love. I mean, you know, 1 John 4. And other places in the Bible, God is telling Joshua, in the book of Joshua, to go into the city of Ai and kill every living thing, cut open the stomachs of pregnant women, kill the dogs, cut off the king's head, and put it on a pike on the front of the city so that everybody will realize how ferocious a God he is. I mean, those are fairly different natures of God.
Well, I mean, he's a God of justice, and he's the one who makes the law.
Well, if he's a God of justice, how come he's sitting around with the devil figuring out, the, you know, saying, hey, let's play games with Job's brain?
Well, God has given us choice.
No, but seriously, have you read the book of Job?
Oh, yeah, I've read Job.
So, the book of Joshua, for that matter. I mean, is this the God that, in its entirety, that you want to submit your life to?
As a Christian, yes.
Okay. I don't think that that's the God that Jesus was talking about.
I think
that the conception of the divine, of ultimate deity, over time changes. And during the Bronze Age was, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago, was very different than it was during the time of Christ, and frankly is different than it is now. And, you know, I don't think that God created us. I think we create those gods. I mean, So obviously something brought all this into being, but, you know, what that is has been, the concept of that has changed a lot of times in the course of human history. I mean, who was the God before, you know, the Jewish tribe emerged and started writing down the Old Testament Bible? You've got, I mean, you know, look at Aboriginal religions, look at all these other religions. I mean, people have been around for 165,000 years. We've not always had the Bible.
Well, that's true. I mean, that doesn't, you know, discount what the Bible says.
Well, you know, no. If you want to take it as a book of religion or even a book of morality, I agree. And but if you want to take it as science, it does. Science changes over time. And frankly, religions change over time. But they're completely different categories of things. And I said it before, I'll say it again. I think that teaching religion to children as science is child abuse. I think it's wrong. I think it's a bad thing for the kids, and it's a bad thing for our society. And then telling taxpayers that they have to pay for it is adding insult to injury. Damon, thanks for the call. I guess we're going to have to agree to disagree. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's interesting to wonder where it all came from, but, you know, that's the only place where science and theology enters. And welcome back. Dave, in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind, Dave? Thanks for watching Dish Network.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You covered quite a few points I had, like science is always evolving and changing, and while the concept of creationism is absolute, no ends and or buts about it, and I think it's highly symbolic. And, you know, religion is it gives people comfort. And gives them, you know, I don't think that the humans really have the brain capacity to really truly understand everything out there. But, you know, your beliefs are your beliefs. But I agree with you that teaching it as an absolute thing is dangerous. And I've got a thing about why is God always referred to in the masculine term? Like,
right.
He did this and he did that.
Yeah, the deity has a penis.
It would make more sense to, like Mother Earth, Mother Nature. You come from a female, a human does anyway.
Yeah.
And then for us to be humans, to be in God's image, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, if you have a patriarchal, dominator, male-dominated religion, then they're going to create a god or gods in their own image. They're going to create them with penises. They're going to create them as men. If you have, and you see this, you know, in those kind of societies. On the other hand, societies that are closer to the earth, societies that are, you know, many of your Aboriginal religions, their deities are gender neutral, or their deities are female and male, and or with the pantheists, I mean, everything is essentially alive with the spirit of life. It's all, everything is a deity, everything, you know, including humans. And but it's all, everything has its spirit that has to be honored and respected. And that's the religion that I, at the core, I think is at the core of ultimately of Christianity and Judaism, and at the core of all real religion and of real religious experience is pantheism.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So. Well, you know, all I know is right now I am here right now talking to you, and I'm happy about that. Other than that, my further understanding of what's going on is limited. So
yeah.
I'll leave you with that.
Okay. Dave, well said. None of us know. None of us know. Fletcher in, thank you, Dave. Fletcher in Bristol, New Hampshire. Hey, Fletcher, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to hear you. Thanks for letting me on, brother.
Mm-hmm.
Science without religion is a monster. And have you heard this before?
This is,
religion without
this is,
science. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Go ahead.
Religion without science is, you know, a bunch of religious fanatics. But I
yeah, really you're paraphrasing Einstein, by the way.
I think it's Aldous Huxley.
Could be. I thought it was Albert Einstein, but either one. That's,
we're close. We're in the same neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reviews like say they. Are you with me?
I'm listening.
They did a review of your station. I'm sure you'd come out great. And, well, on a legal circumstance, if you people have, let's say, a divorce or a criminal case, so...
I'm listening, Fletcher. You got about 10 seconds.
Well, they can have them reviewed.
Yeah.
Same with a judge. They can have a judge reviewed.
Okay. And they should. Fletcher, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Thursday, let's get geeky. The 3 minutes out of the week when Louise and Sean let me talk about my favorite topic, science, one of my favorite topics. Yesterday, the FDA announced that it's going to ask pharmaceutical companies to help stop the abuse and overuse of antibiotics on farms. So why is the FDA making this request? Because, you know, the FDA has to do with us and our health and our drugs, not animals on farms. Well, it's because big meat is addicted to antibiotics. In fact, according to Think Progress, factory farming operations account for nearly 80% of the antibiotics used in the United States every year. Factory farms give cattle, chicken, and pigs nearly 30 million pounds of antibiotics every year to speed up their growth and to prevent the spread of diseases that pop up when hundreds of animals are packed into small spaces. But big meat's overuse of antibiotics has caused foodborne illnesses that were once rare, like salmonella and E. coli, to mutate and become resistant to antibiotics. As a result, more than half of the meat sold in the U.S., whether it's beef, chicken, or pork, contains antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And that means more and more people are getting sick. It didn't always used to be this way. Believe it or not, there was a time when cows and chickens weren't chock full of drugs and outbreaks of E. coli were not making the nightly news. Before factory farming really took off around 15, 25 years ago, you could eat a raw egg without the fear of getting violently ill from salmonella. You can even drink a glass of raw milk straight from the cow without having to worry about E. coli. But today, raw eggs and raw milk are two very big no-nos thanks to the boom in drug-resistant bacteria. Big Meat argues that antibiotics are necessary to keep animals and consumers healthy, but that clearly isn't the case. There are plenty of countries where meat is consumed regularly that have bans on antibiotic use in animals. As Think Progress points out, the meat industries in these countries control disease outbreaks in factory farm animals by using clean facilities and by not shoving hundreds of animals together in small spaces. And those measures work fine without the use of antibiotics. Just 0.00009% of people in the European Union, which banned non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in 1998, get a foodborne illness like Salmonella or E. coli every year. That's less than 0.0001%. That's compared to 15% of Americans. So let's hope the FDA's efforts work and that pharmaceutical companies stop handing out antibiotics to big meat. In the meantime, you might want to lay off the burgers, the chicken, and the pork. There you go. Charles in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, listening on TuneIn Radio. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I read your 2016 read just about a month ago. Enjoyed it very much. Are you there?
I am. Thank you. I'm listening.
Okay, good. I wanted to draw a perspective on the difference between operational science and historical science.
Mm-hmm.
Historical science, dealing with origins, where we came from, the meaning of it all, that's something that cannot be proven.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Darwinian evolution falls within that category of historical science. I believe that DNA and simple protein creation is an example of things that cannot be explained by pure chance, by undirected activity. And so I draw a distinction there between...
You think that it requires an intelligence to assemble, to create adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, and deoxyribonucleic acid and assemble them into DNA and into living organisms. Is that what you're saying?
I do.
Okay.
I believe...
Don't you think it's possible that just that's the natural tendency of certain chemicals when they get together and they get mixed up in the soup of seawater and get hit by electricity? I mean, I thought they did that through those experiments back in the 60s where they actually created simple amino acids by which would form themselves into those amines eventually.
Well, actually, Tom, the research on that indicates that the atmosphere at the creation of that scenario that you're describing would require it be as even the experiment was, it did not have any oxygen in that example.
Well, there was very little oxygen.
Universe.
But all that means is that the DNA would be the DNA for non... what's the word for things that don't survive in oxygen? Non-aerobic,
non-reduced
life forms, rather life forms that live off, you know, nitrogen or sulfur. But over time, when the first plants emerged that used photosynthesis that converted carbon dioxide in the atmosphere into oxygen, they changed the atmosphere so much they killed off I think they're called cyanobacteria, the red bacteria and the red forms of life that preceded them. And, I mean, you know, life changed as our atmosphere changed.
Yes. Well, that's a good discussion, Tom. But let me kind of segue, though, into the emphasis of your 2016 book, which is a premise that we should have a compassion for all of society and just not a society based on the power of the 1%. And the smaller percentage. And so if Darwinian evolution is true, and if it is purely nothing more of our planet and our life and our existence, purely undirected chance without purpose, then what's wrong with the 1% saying that I see in our society a population of people that are just living off of the resources
that are ready to exploit. No, Charles, I get it. This is the argument that Charles Darwin's cousin made, Sir Francis Galton, I think his name was. And when he invented a school of economics during the Victorian era that used Darwin's theories or purported to use Darwin's theories. And Darwin repudiated this. And he said, essentially, no, survival of the fittest as a phrase only exists once in Darwin's books it is, but whatever. He only used that phrase once. Cooperation appears over and over and over again. Darwin's theories, David Loy has done, L-O-Y-E, has done some brilliant writing on this. Darwin's theories were essentially that interdependence, cooperation, collaboration, and love, and yes, Darwin uses that word love repeatedly, whereas survival of the fittest appears once. He uses that phrase repeatedly to describe how nature interacts with itself. So I would say that that's anybody who justifies, you know, Mitt Romney's lifestyle using Darwin is mischaracterizing Darwin.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you do if you're absolutely committed to destroying a presidency? What do you do? What do you do if you want to make sure that a president goes down in history badly and that his or her legacy and that of his or her party is one of failure? Of course, the easiest thing to do is blow up the economy. Just look at Herbert Hoover. Hoover was a very thoughtful president who did or tried to do a lot of things for the nation. By the standards of today's politics, he might even be called a moderate Democrat, although he was a Republican. He was a strong supporter of regulation, supported tariffs on imports. He helped create America's national park system, many of this nation's VA hospitals. He proposed a national pension plan, which was rejected by Congress. He tried to give low-income Americans a tax cut, which was also shot down by a Republican-controlled Congress. But despite his list of accomplishments and relatively rational policies, Hoover will forever be remembered by history as being the guy who was in the White House when the stock market crashed in 1929, like 8 months into his presidency. Right now, America is really, really vulnerable because of 32 years of Reaganomics and because of Phil Gramm's massive deregulation of the banksters, with Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, back at the end of the Clinton presidency. Our economy is also weak because of insane trade policies adopted by both the Reagan and the Clinton presidencies. I mean, it really doesn't take a lot to keep our economy in the gutter or to make it even worse. And because giant corporations have shut down in the last decade, over 2 million U.S. jobs and shipped them overseas, government spending has become a strong lever that can flip the economy for better or for worse. So if you want to completely crash the economy, the best way to do it is to slash government spending. And that's exactly what Republicans have been doing ever since President Obama lost a filibuster-proof Senate when Scott Brown was sworn in to replace the late Ted Kennedy on February 4th, 2010. As economist Paul Krugman brilliantly points out in his blog for the New York Times, real government spending has been in a free fall since 2010, all thanks to Republican-driven austerity measures. As Krugman writes, you can see that there was a brief, modest spurt in spending associated with the Obama stimulus, but it has long since been outweighed and swamped by a collapse in spending without precedent in the past half century. Much of the recent drop in real government spending is associated with the devastating sequester, which Republicans know is the most brutal and terrible form of austerity, and the form of austerity that is most likely to wreck the economy and therefore destroy the Obama presidency. And that's why conservative groups are committed to having the sequester hit Americans at full force, which is why they're attacking fellow conservatives in Washington, D.C., like Paul Ryan, who are willing to just slightly release the brakes on austerity. These conservative groups and their affiliated members in Congress aren't just partisan politicians or conservative ideologues. They're radicals, hell-bent on destroying the Obama presidency and the Democratic Party in the process. The bad news here is that because of gerrymandering, these radicals control the House, and the Senate continue to filibuster any legislation that might improve the economy. But the good news is that Americans are finally starting to figure out which party is on their side and what Republicans are really all about. These guys aren't statesmen. They're not even decent politicians. They're political hacks and shills for the billionaire class and for the corporations, and they want to destroy the party that stands for the interests of working Americans. Do you have, Shane, do you have that clip, FDR five clips? It's, if you can easily find it, it's the next to the last and last clips, I think. But this is what FDR said back in 1936 when he was nominated to be president. He said, "These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power." He goes on to say, "In vain they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution. In their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, they stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection, and against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike." You get the clip? No? Okay. It's time to call out these overprivileged economic royalists for what they really are. They're not conservatives. They're not Republicans in a way that Barry Goldwater or Ronald Reagan would recognize. These guys are political thugs. Plain and simple. I don't know any other way to say it. You know, I'm pretty sure I've got it here. And hang on just a second. FDR. Here we go. I got it. I can play it from my computer. And it is coming up right now. Here we go. Okay. This is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1936.
"These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power."
Now, can you imagine President Obama saying, you know, "Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of the Koch brothers' kind of power. It requires the overthrow of Shelley Adelson's kind of power."
"In vain they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution. But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection."
There you go. And the people went nuts, and they said, "Yes, you are right. You are our president. We will reelect." This was the end of his first term, and he was calling these guys out. You know, if I had any control over the viewing room, you know, the theater in the White House where the president can go and watch movies and things, I would get old FDR newsreels and say, "You got to see this. You got to see this. You got to listen to this." You know, here's FDR. I mean, you know, he's just calling these guys out. He's just, you know, it's just. Oops. There it goes.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private.
Too private.
It became privileged enterprise.
Privileged.
Not free enterprise.
Yeah, it became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise. And then it created the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and then it took over the Republican Party, and then it took over America, and now we have a serious problem with a political thug class now starting to eat their own. I mean, now they're going after John Boehner, of all people. 15 minutes past that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, things have gone over the edge when FDR is the salvation for the Republican Party. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Michelle in Maynard, Iowa. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Yeah, I was calling about the creationists
yeah.
And how they are against science, but they're also against history.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the creation of the Bible, many of the stories are, when they were first created, were oral. And eventually they would be written down. Because if you look at the stories of Jesus in the New Testament, each book is written several years after Jesus had lived.
Oh, several centuries. You know, a century or more, yeah. And it looks like the book that was most closely written most closely to the time that he lived was Mark, and the Book of Thomas, which never made it into the canon, the canonical literature, but is a fascinating read. You know, in the Book of Thomas, he says, "Lift a rock, and I am there. Split a piece of wood, and I am there." I mean, it's just some remarkable statements. But yeah, and not only that, a lot of the stuff that you'll find in the Bible, you'll find in religions that are thousands of years older than the Bible. You'll find in Zoroastrianism, and you'll find in other, you know, in the tribal societies that preceded the tribe that became the modern day Jews and then the modern day Christians and Muslims, for that matter.
Yes. And basically, if you look at the when the Bible was written, I mean, not being from Hebrew, and then translations over time into German and English, the translation of the words get lost.
Yes, in many cases.
So a lot of the people, like the meaning gets lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree. I think more importantly, though, Michelle, is that over time, cultures, religions and cultures choose to selectively emphasize pieces of the Bible and de-emphasize others and say, oh, this place where they condemn or appear to condemn homosexuality, for example, that needs to be really, really, you know, as if it's the entire Bible. And this place where they condemn eating shellfish, that needs to be just largely ignored. And yet they're in the same place in Leviticus. And so this kind of selective interpretation of Old Testament, New Testament, you know, we had somebody call yesterday about the Second Thessalonians, you know, where Paul said, you know, he doesn't work, shall not eat. And what he was really talking about was spiritual work and eating, you know, getting spiritual blessings in the context of eating. But Michelle Bachman has literally used this as a justification for doing away with food stamps. And it's like, really? Really? Is that what we mean to do? Is, you know, we're going to pervert and twist and torture religion to the extent that we can use it to justify cutting food off from people and call ourselves Christians? I find it amazing.
Yep.
Michelle, thank you very much for watching Free Speech TV in Maynard or Iowa there. I appreciate the call. Thank you. And this is, you know, one of the most interesting periods of time in my life was in my 20s when I read the Bible. The first time fairly selectively in my early 20s, and then in my late 20s for 4 years in a row. Every night before I went to sleep, I read. You know, it was one of those through the Bible in a year books, where you read part of the first half of the Old Testament, the first half of the New Testament, or the second half of the Old Testament, the first half of the New Testament, the second half of the New Testament every night before you go to sleep. Read the entire book four times for 4 years. It was amazing. You know, just for the fun of it, let's visit FDR again, okay? It's been a while since I've listened to this clip, so I'm not sure exactly what's in it, but it's titled, this is a title I gave it, Fireside Chat, May 1940, Millionaires and Conservative Poison. So let's find out what FDR, now the Fireside Chats, FDR every week, I believe it was, would sit down with Americans. They only had radio back then. And would just have a conversation. Here's what's going on. In 1940, this was before we had entered World War II. This was as we were dealing with the Great Depression. That was the struggle, the Great Depression. Franklin Roosevelt.
It is whispered by some that only by abandoning our freedom, our ideals, our way of life, can we build our defenses adequately, can we match the strength of the aggressors. I did not share those illusions. I do not share these fears. Today we are more realistic, but not let us not be calamity howlers and discount our strength. Let us have done with both fears and illusions.
So apparently there were people who were running around, you know, trying to talk us into war. Ultimately we got there. And
and our airplanes and our guns and our ships may be our first lines of defense. It is still clear that way down at the bottom, underlying them all, giving them their strength, sustenance, and power, are the spirit and the morale of a free people. For that reason, we must make sure in all that we do that there be no breakdown or cancellation of any of the great social gains which we have made in these past years. We have carried on an offensive on a broad front against social and economic inequalities.
Inequality?
Against abuses which had made our society weak. That offensive should not now be broken down by the pincers movement of those who would use the present needs of physical military defense to destroy it.
Very interesting. He must have been preparing for war very clearly.
There is nothing in our present emergency to justify a lowering of the standards of employment. Minimum wages should not be reduced.
Now, when he said present emergency, he was referring to the Great Depression. That was the phrase he used to refer to the Great Depression.
There is nothing in our present emergency to justify a breaking down of old age pensions or of unemployment insurance. I would rather see the systems extended to other groups who do not now enjoy them. There is nothing in our present emergency to justify a retreat, any retreat from any of our social objectives, from conservation of natural resources, assistance to agriculture, housing, and help to the underprivileged.
It's interesting. I wonder if by present emergency, I said this is 1940. This is before World War II, before Pearl Harbor Day. I wonder if he was talking about the war in Europe.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
I wonder if I just have the year wrong, because this he's talking like we're at war. So perhaps this is after 41.
Today's threat to our national security.
That's a threat.
Is not a matter of military weapons alone. We know of other methods, new methods of attack.
Uh-oh. New methods of attack against the United States? What's that?
There is an added technique for weakening a nation at its very roots, for disrupting the entire pattern of life of a people. And it's important that we understand it. The method is simple. First, discord. The dissemination of discord. A group, not too large, a group that may be sectional or racial or political, is encouraged to exploit its prejudices through false slogans and emotional appeals. The aim of those who deliberately egg on these groups is to create confusion of counsel, public indecision, political paralysis, and eventually a state of panic.
Very, very interesting. Well, maybe this was May of 1940, which is how I have it labeled. Pre-war.
Men can lose confidence in each other and therefore lose confidence in the efficacy of their own united action. Faith and courage can yield to doubt and fear. The unity of the state can be so sapped that its strength is destroyed. All this is no idle dream. It has happened time after time in nation after nation during the last 2 years. Fortunately, American men and women are not yet easy dupes. Campaigns of group hatred or class struggle have never made much headway among us and are not making headway now. But new forces are being unleashed. Deliberately planned propagandas to divide and weaken us in the face of danger as other nations have been weakened before. These dividing forces I do not hesitate to call undiluted poison.
Wow.
They must not be allowed to spread in the new world as they have in the old. Our moral, our mental defenses must be raised up as never before against those who would cast a smokescreen across our vision.
Wow. Can you imagine if President Obama came out and said the American Legislative Exchange Council is undiluted poison for right-wing talk radio?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think by that time, Father Coughlin had been pulled off the air. He had just gone totally over the top in support of Hitler. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is Franklin Roosevelt. This was his first inaugural address. So this was March of 1933. Adolf Hitler had not, I don't believe at that point in time, even become Chancellor of Germany. Now, the last speech we heard was 6 or 8 months after Hitler had invaded Poland. So there was a very serious risk of our getting involved in World War II, which we ultimately were. But this, he's talking entirely about the Great Depression.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Anyhow, enough of my nostalgia. No, I wasn't alive when FDR was, but I get nostalgic on behalf of my grandfather, who was FDR was one of his great heroes. Jim in Boston. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I find your show very addictive. I cannot stop listening
Thank you.
While I work during the day.
Thank you.
I have two comments. One, keep it short. I was thinking it might be good to ask congressmen and senators to forego a flu shot, or maybe just use last year's flu shot so that they don't deplete the new flu shot for the rest of us if they think that creationism should be taught in schools.
because viruses mutate and via a process described by Darwin as evolution, and therefore they shouldn't get because they don't believe in evolution, the new flu shot for the new mutated virus, they shouldn't bother with.
Well, yeah, God only created one flu.
Right.
So they only need, the one that was out 8 years ago.
That's brilliant. I wish I had thought of that when what's his name was on the phone. That is brilliant. Jim, thanks a lot for that. Thank you so much. Marcia in Smyrna, Georgia. Hey, Marcia.
Hi, Tom. I don't even know where to begin. About this Bible and truth and translation and so forth. First of all, are you familiar with a book called And God Said?
No, I'm not.
By Joel Hoffman. It's wonderful. It goes and looks at all the misconceptions we have because of the way the Bible was translated. You can't take, when you look at the Bible, and I study every Saturday morning, you can't look at a passage in the Bible without looking at it in the context in which it was set and in the context and the agenda of the redactors who wrote it down.
Yes. And who edited it over the centuries.
Right, right. My favorite example is from Joel Hoffman. In Song of Songs, it talks about, there's a line that says, "My sister, my love."
Mm-hmm.
And people go berserk over this because it sounds incestuous.
Right.
Turns out that in that era, when you spoke of someone below you, you called them my son, sociologically below you. When you spoke to someone above you, you called him my father. So the king might say to you, my son. And you would say to the king, my father. But if your lover calls you his sister, then he's putting his lover on the same plane, the same hierarchical plane.
So it's like saying you're my equal.
You're my
peer.
Equal. And that's what it was all about.
Huh.
So that's just one example of how we get twisted.
Sure. Yeah, that's brilliant. Have you ever read Robert Funk's book, The Five Gospels?
No, that one I haven't, but I know about it.
Yeah, this came out of the Jesus Project, which had a lot of Jewish scholars as well as Christian scholars, and I think there might have been some Muslim scholars in there, where they took all of the words of Jesus out of the four Gospels and ranked them word by word with four colors, bright red, pink, gray and black, and bright red, as I recall, is he certainly definitely said that. Pink was he probably said that. Gray was he almost certainly didn't say that, probably didn't say that. And black was he definitely did not say that. There's historical proof he didn't say that. And it's the four Gospels, only wherever Jesus is talking, these are bolded out and in these four colors. And it's an amazing read. I mean, it's just an amazing read. Anyhow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
The things that are quoted from Jesus in the New Testament that are supposed to be his words, if you check them out, he got most of them from the Psalms and from Proverbs and from the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, when you say Jesus was Jewish, he really was Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
This was the text that he had. And
that's why his followers called him rabbi like 36 times. I mean,
right. Oh, by the way, when you talk about rabbi meaning teacher, rabbi doesn't mean teacher. The word for teacher is more. Rabbi or rav means my lord or my master, as a student sitting at the feet of his master.
Interesting.
Would say.
Yeah.
I was a long time before learning that one.
Yeah. Well, the disciples referred to him as our lord, too. So
right.
It might have been that they were saying rabbi.
Exactly.
Yeah, and sometimes it's translated as teacher. Marcia, I want to get some more callers in here. Thank you for sharing that with me. I appreciate it. It's good stuff. Seth in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tom. How are you? Can you hear me?
I do, yeah. It's not great. It sounds like you're on a speakerphone. What's up?
I'm on Skype.
Oh, okay.
I mentioned a Native American look at comparative religion that's very interesting. They look at religion in the four directions based on skin color. There's the red family from the West, the Americas, white in the North in Europe, yellow from the East in Asia and Australia, and black in the South from Africa. And each of these families have their own religious tradition. And then the Middle East is in the center of the world, of course. That is a way to look at comparative religion in terms of how we perceive the religious traditions of the world. So in other words, if you can break down your understanding of religious traditions in that light, you can begin to understand how religious traditions came about, and you can categorize and understand traditions like Native American tradition or African traditional religions or, you know, Asian traditions such as Buddhism or Hinduism or pagan traditions from Europe, those kinds of things. Does that make sense?
It makes a certain amount of sense. I'm reminded by a couple nights ago, I had a conversation with Joe Madison on the TV show, and he said, you know, the only difference between us, and I think he wasn't so much referring to him and me as African-Americans and European Caucasian-Americans, he said, is melanin. It's this pigment in our skin. It's, you know, and it's just an amount. It's the only difference. Everybody wants the same things. Everybody wants their kids to grow up well. Everybody wants to be happy in life. Everybody wants to be loved.
Well, that's true. That is very true.
I think it's time that we start breaking down these racial lines and barriers.
Oh, I don't mean to say that we aren't one people. What I'm saying is that, and this is something that Native Americans acknowledge, is that we have approaches to religion that are distinct, but that doesn't mean that we aren't.
Yeah, I think we have to. Yeah, okay, good point, Seth, and we do have to acknowledge that. A very interesting point. Thank you for the call, Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Just a quick one. I'd just like to parallel the generational theory you were talking about to our times and Wall Street. I want to parallel to the Roman Empire. Now, it took generations to get to Caesar. Then it went to Octavian. Then it went to Tiberius. Then it went to Caligula. And then it went to Wall Street, Nero. What are your thoughts? Thank you, Tom.
That's interesting. Michael, I don't know enough about the history of the Roman Empire to comment, but I'm guessing there are people who are listening who do, and maybe we'll hear from them. It's a fascinating metaphor. Robert in Santa Maria, California. Hey, Robert.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi.
Waiting a while. I have a little short story similar to yours. When I was 10 years old, I read everything I could get my hands on. I was in Los Angeles. And then my mother took me out to the Little Bay of Tar Pits and showed me a damn skeleton of a dinosaur, and that puzzled me because in all my reading of the Bible, I could not remember seeing a dinosaur. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky enough to have a huge library in downtown Los Angeles that had everything in it. So I went down on my own and I started going through their books and started going through their scholars about the Bible, and I have learned then, and I'm still convinced, and that all this discussion about the gods and the churches are all discussions about Santa Claus, and you're really all spinning your wheels.
Yeah, I think these are all ways to make sense out of things that don't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't take that much to find out who wrote the Bible, and if you want to believe what some guy scribbled, well, I'll scribble you out a Bible tomorrow, and then you can donate to me because I'd appreciate the money.
Okay, Robert, thank you for the call. Yeah, very thought-provoking. 15 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Program. Taking back the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. This new study, this is really worth repeating. A new study just came out that found over the last 4 years, 3 million jobs were created that make less than $15 million an hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
While roughly 3 million jobs were lost that paid more than $15 an hour, we are watching the disintegration of the American middle class right now. And welcome back, Johnny in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Hey, Johnny, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Yes, thank you, Tom. I really enjoy your program and appreciate everything you say.
Thank you.
I'm not necessarily a creationist, but I just had a question about evolution. If evolution is true, then why aren't apes evolving into humans right now?
Well, first of all, Darwin had this notion that evolution was a slow and gradual process. That has been largely discarded by evolutionary scientists. And the theory that is more frequently embraced is Stephen Jay Gould's variation on it, and variations on Stephen Jay Gould's theory of punctuated equilibrium, that evolution actually moves in fits and starts, that there are worldwide events or local events that are catastrophic. And as a consequence of that event, a small number of mutants, basically, people who carry a mutation or members of that species that carry a mutation, that survive that event. I'll give you two examples, one with bacteria and one with people. The one with bacteria is when they started using massive amounts of antibiotics. 80% of the antibiotics produced in the United States right now are fed to animals. Started using massive amount of antibiotics for animals. The antibiotics were killing off the E. coli, which is a normal gut bacteria. And, you know, it might a pig's E. coli might make us, have a little diarrhea for a half a day, make us a little bit sick, but it wouldn't kill us. And so as the antibiotics killed off the E. coli, the only E. coli that survived were the ones that were mutants, that had a gene variation that allowed them to not be affected by the antibiotic, whether it was, a receptor on the surface of the cell or whatever. You know, the antibiotic didn't hurt them. And there's a variety of ways, different ways that happened. And over time, not only did they become more and more resistant to the antibiotics, but they became more and more pathogenic. They became more and more destructive. So now we have E. coli H157, for example, that will kill you if you get it. It'll shut down your kidneys, and it's a big problem. Same thing with Salmonella. The example with people is that during the Great Plague, they've just discovered in the last 5 years or so that there are some people who are immune to AIDS, that they literally are immune to AIDS. They can be infected with AIDS, and they don't get it. And they try to figure out where what is it that makes these people immune to AIDS? It turns out that people who survived the Black Plague in Europe, 100% of these people were white European ancestry, people who survived the Black Plague in Europe carry a gene for a way that their body deals with infection that allowed them to survive the Black Plague. And if both of your parents carried that gene, a full expression of that gene, so that both of their parents carried a full expression of that gene, so this is like, 1/100th of 1% of the population, of the white population, it's a very small percentage. But if both of your parents and both of your grandparents carried the full expression of that gene, you are immune to AIDS. Those are examples of evolution, of what are called bottlenecks in evolution. So if, for example, AIDS was to go aerosolized and everybody in the world was to get it, that 1/100th of 1% of the people who had that gene would be the only survivors. On the other side of that bottleneck, you've got basically a new species. You've got a new kind of bacteria. You've got a new kind of person. And so I would submit to you that apes probably actually are evolving constantly. But the evolution that we're seeing is, because they haven't had bottlenecks, that we're not seeing it quite visibly. Johnny, thank you for the call. Check out Punctuated Evolution. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Dana in Chicago, you want to correct me on Strauss and Howe. I was not so much characterizing Strauss and Howe's characterization of the four generations as I was my own characterization of them. But go ahead and let me know.
In your listing of the generations, you left out the GI generation. Mm-hmm. Which was the greatest generation. You characterized the silent generation as the greatest generation, which is not the case. And also, it wasn't Gen X that brought us Graham Leach Bliley. It was the baby boom that brought us Graham Leach Bliley.
Arguably. It was the flip side of that. It was Gen X who voted for the baby boomers who made those laws, who changed those laws. The numbers that I was quoting you, where I was saying if you turned 18 during this period of time, you voted this way, which is from this Washington Post article today. Those were all young voters as opposed to the old legislators. So I would submit that the old legislators are responding to the demands of the young voters, of the new majority voters.
Okay. Well, the other thing, you know, Strauss and Howe characterize the missionary generation. They characterized the baby boomers. I think we're supposed to be the missionary generation, but I think we're actually the zealot generation.
Hmm.
And I think you were kind of zealots and kind of know-it-alls, and that's where I think some of what's going on is coming from these days.
Could be.
I think we have a great deal of influence. And I'm also, if I can skitter off into one other point, the thing about, I was wondering what exactly the emergency was that FDR was talking about in that speech in 1940. I think it was because the Germans had just conquered most of Western Europe.
Yes, they had just invaded Poland in 1939, and by May had fallen. Yeah, this is May of 1940, so that would make sense.
Yeah, and he was talking about the emergency of all the voices calling for to get into war and to stay out of war.
Yes,
and he was a great tightrope walker.
Oh, he was, and there was also the our alliance with Great Britain. And, providing them with war material and the whole Lend-Lease program and all. Was that World War One, Lend-Lease? I could be mixing up my wars. Yeah.
It was World War II.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I don't pretend to be a scholar of World War II or of that time period. The war stuff I always skipped over. The economics, I can tell you when, tariffs went up and down, almost year by year, or when taxes went up and down. But the war stuff I don't get. But, yeah, I think that's the crisis that he was talking about, is that Europe was in flames opposed to the Great Depression. I think you're right, Dana. Thank you for calling and for the rational perspective. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael.
Hi. Yes, nice hearing from you. I'll give you a compliment. This is one thing. Your show and its quality is one thing that was not present during FDR's administration or thereafter. This is far superior to anything in our lifetimes, which are about the same time.
Well, thank you. Although I would submit to you that most journalism in FDR's day was pretty straightforward, like I think this show is.
Yeah, I think the journalism was better, but I don't think there was an intellectual forum like this. But let's get to my point. This is something that you should have some insight into. I don't understand the mass basis for Republican voting. That is, it's true that, yes, they're a minority, and yes, the Koch brothers have incentive to vote Republican. But what's the incentive? Is it just pure racism? What is the incentive for massive numbers of people to vote the way the Republicans do? I listen to your libertarian debaters on The Big Picture, and they puzzle me. I see all this resentment against poor people, but little resentment about corporations, which are often ripping them off more than the poor people. So I just wondered what your insight on that point is.
Well, I would say that, and Thomas Frank, I think, captured this well in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, that what the Republican Party has done as shills for the billionaire class and for the transnational corporations is they have figured out in which parts of the country which issues will motivate people to get them to the polls. So when they go out to Colorado, to rural Colorado, they talk about guns and how those liberals from the big city in New York want to take away your gun, like they don't allow guns in New York City anymore. And when they go down to Mississippi and they're talking to white voters, they talk about black people. Those black people want to take your job or, they want to rape your daughter or something. I mean, that was the old blatant racism, but the new racism is not really that different. The subtexts and the themes are still there. And, I mean, the Willie Horton ad and all this kind of stuff. Willie Horton, who had actually committed, rape and murder, as I recall. And in San Francisco, that's probably look out, the gays are coming to get you. I'm not sure, how... I would guess they're probably most of the Republican targeting with the anti-gay message over the years has been probably largely in areas that are mostly white and that are not rural, that are urban. And so the major, it's you don't have a lot of gun owners, so the gun message isn't going to resonate. And then there are some areas where the Protestant church is really active and the fundamentalist Protestant church is really active, and they're coming into conflict with the Catholic Church. And in those areas, they'd come in and they'd say, these liberals want to do away with your religion. And so they get people to the poll, and then abortion was another one. And so they get people to the polls based on these what are called wedge issues, and the people are voting those issues rather than voting their own economic self-interest. And the economic self-interest is really the only reason that the Republican Party exists, but you know, or is as well-funded as it is. Am I making sense?
Yeah, because it's the income. Yeah, it makes sense. It's the income. You're saying that you have resentment to people who are busy and don't have that much time, and they exploit whatever they can, and they change their tune to speak to the people.
Oh, absolutely. And they very much change their tune from place to place all around the country, and that's fairly easily deduced. So go back and look up Nixon's Southern Strategy, for example. Anyhow, Michael, thank you very much for the call, and thank you for listening to the program there in Boston or in the suburbs in Brookline. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday the 13th. That means brunch with Bernie. Not the 13th part, but Friday. America's Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be talking with you about the important issues of the day and taking your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there. Show up. Occupy something. Tag your it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.